Blog Talk Radio. Well, good evening, and welcome to Lenny Gott's Straight No Chaser. This evening, I have an exciting guest to speak with and have a conversation with. I'm going to hold back before I introduce her because I'm going to get my housekeeping out of the way and the introductions for next week out of the way because I know we're going to need every minute of the 55 minutes that we'll have left to talk about all the things that we talk about as we do on the telephone all the time. But first, I'd like to say thank you very much for listening to blogtalkradio.com. And if you really want to hear other episodes, you go to blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Frank, S as in Sam, sorry, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. That will get you the older episodes, and we're almost up to about 20 episodes then. And now, if you want to call in at 516-453-6063. Call in, let us know how you're doing, let us know what you think of the guest, and if you have any questions about her. Next week, it's going to be an interesting week because I'm going to talk to Lehigh Valley residents. And I say that the one is Judith A. Harris, and she's the president of the Board of Trustees for the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival. And we'll talk about how arts has influenced her life because she is really an estate of planning and tax attorney. And the other is Al Jacobson. Al and Judith are going to be on the show together. And Al is formerly from the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. He's an executive there, but he is now our executive director of the Allentown Miller Symphony Hall. And so I have the opportunity and the pleasure to talk to them next week. But be now to introduce you to my guest this evening. It is my pleasure to talk about this woman who I met on my first job of doing a situation comedy many years ago on NBC. She was the star of that and is always the star in my life, but she's the star of that production. And I can tell you that it is one memory of my first days on there that she made memorable. She was the most wonderful host and leading lady of that particular studio. She welcomed everyone there. And I had done, and I have done, many other programs. And I have to tell you that she is probably the most lovely host that I'd ever had welcome me on her set. And when I got my own show, I wanted to really pattern myself behind her. She is a producer. I think a motivational and inspirational speaker. She is a multi-award winning actor. She is a good friend, a human being, an activist. She is my good friend, Miss Anna Maria Horsford. Hello, Anna.
Hello, my dear friend. How are you?
Well, I'm so glad that you are here. Thank you. I'm doing well. And you, and how is California this very bright day out here in the East?
Hot, hot, hot. Hot, hot, hot. But I am grateful for it because at least in California we are consistent, okay? I was working on the East Coast and every other day was winter and one day was spring and the next day was summer. And I said, how do you people live like that? Even though I am from, like you said, Harlem.
That's what I get ready
for. Quick.
Yeah, you just forgot. If you were back here for a little while, you know, I was out there for those 10 years. And when I came back, I had to make that adjustment. You just forgot.
Okay.
But
not me.
You know,
yes.
We have so much to talk about and such a wonderful career, and I don't know if we'll get it all into these 55 minutes, but I want to start with names of two people who I think are really quite wonderful images that I have of them, because we used to talk about them all the time, and then maybe end up with a Bold and Beautiful and Pose and all that. But I want to start with Mr. Victor Horsford and Lillian Agatha. Thank you very much. Richardson Horsford. They were from, respectively, now he's from Antigua and she's from Dominican Republic.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Now you are the how many siblings do you have now, Anna? Please tell
there
me.
There were four of us with my mommy and daddy, and we had two other siblings before those two met.
Okay.
And we grew up as one, which is interesting because years ago I didn't even know what the word step meant. You know, you heard this was your brother and this was your sister, and that's what you went by, you know.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you start saying, well, wait a minute, what is that? And who is that? Everybody was an aunt or uncle. And as you get, like, you get older, well, how did this one? Is that was the sister or the No. Elders were aunts and uncles. And I still have a problem meeting children who don't do, well, not to do that, but kind of respect their elders.
Yes.
You know, like you speak to a little child, a five-year-old, saying, hey, Anna. And I said, no.
Yes,
no,
I've had to make that adjustment. And I make that adjustment.
So,
you know, and I say,
those were, the kind of rules. And then there were other rules of immigrants who came to America. And though they had pretty much, you know, these are unspoken rules, but you just live by them. You know, my mother used to refer to us as you American children. And, which is interesting because she said, you American children, you all have so much. And we didn't know, I guess I didn't know. I didn't think it was an insult, but it was different than her. It was different from them. And
how old was she when she came to America?
She was 19.
Okay. So her
child, remember, it was a cool day and she had a summer dress on and she came in this boat. She said, I was freezing, but I was so happy I was in America. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, and the boat was just coming. Because I never asked how she got here. We just assume, you know, we all assume our own reality. Oh, you flew in and came today. No. You got on a boat, okay? You were boat people. And she said, with my little summer dress, I thought I was cute. I said, you were that excited? She said, I wanted to see my father because she heard about him, and he was here already. And she said, but I couldn't tell anybody. But that's all I wanted to do was see my father, put my eyes on my father. Oh, yeah.
She came by herself? Oh, my.
Well, you better. Oh. I mean, come on, now, ticket fair.
Yes. And then there's your industrious father, who, you know, now you have to people have to understand. We would talk about our parents once we met. Yeah, our parents were alive and kicking and doing things when we were working together. So your father lived to be 100, right?
He lived to 100. He lived to 100 and talked all those days and ate. Every time I would go back to New York, I would say, Daddy, you still alive? He said, yes. And you got a fork in your mouth. He said, I'm going to die with a fork in my mouth. He had a very interesting sense of humor, which is probably where I got mine from. You know, I said, my gosh, Daddy, you are still alive. And he kept saying he didn't want to live to be an old man like his father. I said, but Daddy, you are old. Because my father lost his father when he was about 75 or 77 or something. And he kept saying, I don't want to be an old man like him. I said, but you are an old man. But I guess as long as you have a parent alive, you don't assume that you're old.
No, that's
you
very
know?
True. You know, once the both of my parents and, you know, they're gone, yeah. you then become an adult. You kind of independent and on your own. But I remember talking about you going back and forth. I remember when your mother, you would always make sure she was being taken care of. What a wonderful daughter, I think. You know, I'm partial to that. Being the daughter of two people who were from Florida, but
I think we were gifted because we had, and not to say everybody has it, and I'm always careful to say this. Mm-hmm. We had two people who liked us very much.
You're absolutely right. It's a big gift
and curse, because part of it is you don't have the freedom you think to do a lot, because you lived in the memory or the aura of your parents. I said certain things I would never do, certain parts I've never played, like never think of doing a nude scene. I said,
Well, because you always think maybe when they're gone.
Who knew they were gonna live to be live as old as they did? And I was old. Nobody wanted to see your breasts when you're 75. Okay, so I couldn't do any nude scenes. Hello.
My consciousness was always, you know, let me do things that they would be proud of, that, you know, I could see mother's face, you know.
Exactly.
Say, why would you even choose to do something like that? But, you know, now I want, you talked about, because I've been listening to a lot of the interviews you did over time, over years, and you talked about your mother being smart enough to channel your energy. That's what I call it, to channel your energy, because you're an energetic child. And
well, they call it a child who has a lot of problems with ADD, okay?
Yes.
I would start a project and go. I mean, I was hyperactive. That's what they call it, but they weren't diagnosing. Yeah, they didn't diagnose it then. I don't know if they had a title for it, but I was the third of four children who had a lot of energy, a lot of creative energy. And
she
realized she couldn't control it. Because my mother gave me a spanking every day. And she said, Anna, I realized I couldn't beat it out of you. And I said, why? What did I do? She said, you would do everything I would ask you not to do. And I said, oh, interesting.
But she
I realized. Well, it wasn't, because we got a chance. My mother lived to 90. And so we got a chance to review a lot of my childhood and questions that I had. And she said one day, I can't take it anymore. And my mother was older when she had me. She was 44, 46 or something. And so she was going through her change. And she just said, I can't believe God gave me this child, she said. And one day, she said, she was so exhausted. She said, let's get your coat on. And I said, what? She said, we're going to take a walk. Because she said she realized a spanking didn't stop me from doing certain things that I wanted to do. And I always listened to my instinct more than I listened to others. And I don't know if they were bad. It's just that when you have four children, you want some kind of control of them not hurting themselves. Like, she said, please don't climb up the ladder. And I said, why? And she said, because you're going to fall and hurt yourself. I said, well, how does it feel to hurt myself? And so you say, okay, we're going to do this. So as soon as she left the room, I would crawl. I would get up the ladder and then fall. And if she were correct, I would then offer to commit suicide. And I would run into the kitchen and get the butter knife. I said, I can't take it. And she said, no, Anna, use the sharp knife. I said, no, the butter knife is just as good, just as good. And but thing that helped me was I knew that I had to do this thing because I didn't see it as bad. You know,
well,
I wanted,
there
was something in me that said, just see how that is.
But her insight, though, to channeled that energy, and she used to have someone take you to the movies.
On Saturday, so I wouldn't get in trouble with the other three children. Every Saturday. I was the only one that got a spanking now. The only one. And she paid this woman. Every Saturday, we would go to the RCA movie theater on 125th Street. So I saw maybe 50 movies a year. And then we had other people, because it was a house of all her friends. We had a rooming house my father had. And one would take me down to Radio City Music Hall. And I would see the live shows. So I saw Nat King Cole and Josephine Baker and all of these people, because somehow being in theater, and this is when you say, does God have control over you, over your life, long before you understand what that is, that I was the one who had to go out. Anybody who came said, Lillian, do any of the kids want to go with me to see so-and-so? I said I would, and none of the others wanted to go, but I wanted to go. So I spent a large part of my time as a little girl in theater, live theater and movie theaters.
So,
and I looked at the lady. She came to see me in a play on 42nd Street, and I said, Viola, she was one of the tenants. I said, you know, I think about you all the time because I saw so much stuff with you. I said, you're responsible for me doing all of this. And she laughed, but it was true, because sometimes you need guardians, angels.
Yes. Now, what elementary and junior high school did you go to?
PS 68.
Oh, okay.
It was on 127th Street, and then I went to Wadley Junior High School. And then they got me. Wadley was wonderful. We had a lot of young black teachers who just got out of college who came to Wadley. Wadley had closed down for a while. I think it was a high school, and something happened. They had some tragedy, and then they closed it down for maybe 6 or 7 years, and they opened back up. So they had a lot of black teachers there. And these teachers took us on like we were their children. I am still in touch with my seventh grade typing teacher, Mr. Lavigneau.
Oh, how
wonderful. He had an exotic name. They were gorgeous, gorgeous young black men who had all the style in class. And then I had one teacher who I stayed in touch with for 40-something years, Mr. Chavis, who moved to Las Vegas, and I used to go and see him. And I didn't realize what years, what those, like, 12 to 14 years
those
are really formative.
Yeah, they're very important. Now,
important who sees you differently than you might see yourself. So they would encourage you to join the drama club and the this and that. And then when it came time to audition or take tests for special schools, I said, I want to take the test for performing arts, and I want to take the test for fashion industry. And they were very encouraging. And then I have to tell you, interestingly enough, I got into both schools, and I said, I think I'm going to go to performing arts, because I was the only one from Wadley that got in.
And
my teacher said, Anna, I had an 80 in his class. He said, I'm going to do something I'm not supposed to do. I said, what? He said, I'm going to give you an 85 so you can get on the honor roll. And I said, what? And he said, yeah. I want you to be special. Yeah. And that was our secret. And I said, oh, I don't know what's that. But, you know. And he said, it's a secret between us. I want you to go there on the honor roll. And I said, oh, okay. And let me tell you, the stress of me getting the only one from Wadley Junior High School going to performing arts, they had me do my audition piece for the auditorium. And every day I was there, I kept saying, I got to do good because I don't want to embarrass Wadley. I don't want to embarrass the teachers at Wadley. So when they were asking kids to leave, I was scared to death. I said, they can't ask me to leave. But, of course, there was no way they were going to ask me to leave because I would go overboard.
Mm-hmm.
And every assignment they gave me,
I'm going to ask you about a teacher at Performing Arts that I heard you talk about. I believe the teacher's name is Dr. Dyke.
Oh, that's a lady. She was the head of the drama department.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know something? Mm-hmm. Lenny, Dr. Dyke was the voice and diction teacher. So we had to speak Eastern Standard speech. And it was a small school then. It was 120 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman had face-to-face with each one of us of what we were expected, how we carry ourselves, what we had to do, because being in the performing arts was a big deal. And I have to tell you a funny story. I got a movie yesterday, and after I said yes, I got a note from the director and said, Anna, I don't know if you remember me, but I was in your 10th grade class at Performing Arts. I left the school after 1 year because Performing Arts wouldn't let you work if you were in school. It was a public school. Mm-hmm. And if you were working, you had to go to Children's Professional School.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but I remember you so well. And he said, I left after the first year, but I've been following your career, and I'm so happy we're working together now. Can you imagine at 13 years old?
There you go. That impression. Well, congratulations. Not only.
Well, thank you.
But on your movie.
Thank you.
But now, there's something that Dr. Dykes told you that motivated you, I think, a little bit and impressed you when you got your first job. Because a lot of people know about your career in television and film. But the career really started in theater. And tell them about your first job.
Well, my first professional job was at the public theater, Shakespeare in the Park.
Yes.
And Dr. Dyke would always say it takes 20 years to become an actor. And we didn't know what that meant. So 20 years? God, dog. And I know what she means now. But then you say, I can't wait 20 years for a job now. Come on, you know, we got to do something. And she said, it takes 20 years. And I got this job not assuming that they would call me an actor. So they gave me my first paycheck. I think it was $50 they were paying. I was a gentlewoman in Coriolanus with James Earl Jones and Jane White and Robert Burr. I mean, it was an all-star cast. Mm-hmm. And the young lady gave me a check, and I said, I better hold this check. These people think I'm an actor. How do I tell them I'm not? So the following week she comes, Anna, and I said, oh, I have the check that you wrote last week to give you. And she said, no, that's yours. I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, no, you're going to get a check every week. I said, what? And she said, yes. And I said, talk about stupid. And I said, oh, and I wanted to tell Dr. Dyke, guess what? I'm an actor. And it only took me a year, not even a summer program, because I was in a summer program, an anti-poverty program called How You Act.
Right.
And they had workshops. And that literally was my first job, to get into the drama workshop with Rick Edelstein, who I'm still in contact with. He moved out here.
Wasn't that Kenneth Clark? Wasn't that Kenneth Clark who created that program?
Kenneth Clark, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Hired so many people that summer. I mean, it must have been 1,000 kids from Central Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the music. We had drama. We had journalism. I mean, there were so many programs that all you had to do was be a young teen living in Central Harlem, and you got your first job. I think it was $60 we got. We got $60 a week. And we couldn't, I mean, talk about dance. I mean, all the people who are still in the business, many of them got their first entree into show business. And what that did was build a confidence. Because if you're getting paid as an actor, then nobody can tell you you're not cute.
It really is
building confidence. It's like all the little recitations that you had to learn for church, mm-hmm. and you get that first applause. All mm-hmm. of that is confidence building. To say, I can do stuff, and mommy's not on stage, daddy's not on stage. These are strangers applauding you.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay.
Now, what inspired you to go to Sweden?
The Swedish movies that I used to go and see every weekend. Because now that's talk about a habit I built up.
Mm-hmm.
Movie going is my therapy. Okay? That anytime if you're sad, if you're happy, if you're nervous, go to a movie. And what I do is I can transform myself. I can travel anywhere. I used to love foreign films. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I would go to foreign films and read all of the things in the back, the titles on the bottom of the screen. But I would transport myself to that place, like the L-shaped room with Brock Peters and Leslie Caron. I mean, I remember how I felt when I would come out. It was that you have the ability to go anywhere in your mind. So by the time I auditioned for Yale's Drama School and I didn't get in, and I said, oh, God, what can I do? I said, I'm going to have to fix them. So I said, I'll just go to Sweden and work with Ingmar Bergman.
Now, as you see,
I had a very active imagination. So what I did with my Hall You Act money was I saved, $45 a week for a year and a half, and I saved up enough to get a ticket and some money, and I bought a ticket to go to Luxembourg because they had a sale on, and I said, I'm moving to Stockholm so that I can work with Ingmar Bergman because I knew I had something very special, and for some reason I thought he would understand.
And
just
how was
because
your experience?
Yale didn't understand, huh?
Well, yes. But yeah, you know, I mean, sometimes it's just the timing of all of those things. What was your experience like there, though? What was that exactly?
Well, after I realized I was nervous the night I left for the airport, and my mother said, Emma, what are you doing? And I said, Mommy, I told you I'm going to Sweden. And she said, you know nobody there. What happens? What's going to happen if something happens to you? I said, I'll tell them to send my body back to you. Now, what was going on in my head was, why didn't she try to stop me before? Because I would have called it off. But
yes.
why would she wait until the night I'm leaving?
Yes. Yes.
Okay? And I'm saying, come on, why didn't you do it a little earlier? Because by that time I had sent a trunk over. And all my clothes and stuff, and I had like 4 suitcases, so I couldn't say no then, but I wish she had said no before.
Well,
so
how long
I had
did you
go.
Plan to stay? How long were you going to stay?
I was going to stay forever, you know, come on. Who knew?
Okay.
I should have gone for the weekend and come back. But I stayed for a year because I had started when I was at Wadley, I had a pen pal. And I wrote the pen pal, Claude somebody, and I said, well, listen, I'm moving to Sweden, so let me stop by and see you in France, because I figured it was close. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to Luxembourg, I got on the wrong bus anyway and ended up in Germany. But anyway, I went to see him and the parents and all that, and that was interesting. And I stayed there for about a week, and then I said, okay, I'm moving to, you know, Stockholm. And I bought a rail ticket because back then, and I think you can still do it now, you get a 30-day pass for $150 or something, and you can go to every country.
I don't know.
And when you're young, you have no fear, so you do it. So I went to several countries.
Yeah.
I went to Spain.
Insane. You know, what I'm bridging all of this because, you know, now we're down to a half hour already, okay? See, so I know
Oh, Lord. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But this is good. It'll mean that I'm going to call you again, and you have to finish.
Yes.
But the bridge that your imagination kind of carried you into the arts, beyond the job description of an actor, because so many times people ask me, you know, well, what draws the people to your program? Besides the fact that I really care about the people that I have here, you always have done things outside of your job description. And it is, your resume goes forever. I mean, between Lauren Bacall and Meryl Streep and Beau Bridges and Lou Gossett and stuff, you just have worked with everybody. You make me sick. Okay. But beyond all of that is the visionary that you had, the vision that you had about transporting yourself into a world that you knew nothing about. And how the art did that for you. Now, I'm gonna jump, because I have to jump, because if we don't jump, we're gonna be in this and on Sweden for a while. And I'll have
a telephone. No. We could skip over Sweden. Sweden was fabulous, but go on.
But let's go. How did you get to Seoul? Tell me how you got to Seoul.
Okay. Well, I had just gotten back from Sweden, mm-hmm. and I needed a job. And I went back. I lived with my parents, and I said, okay, how do I get a job now? I have no logical experience. So I said, I'll do office temp.
Mm-hmm.
And office temp got me to work at Channel 13. And that's when I met Ellis Hazlip, who asked me if I want a regular job. And he said, you're very bright. I said, how do you know that? He said, because you ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I said, really? Because I didn't know, again, you need people who see something in you that you don't see.
Exactly.
You know, because I didn't have a college degree. I had gone mm-hmm. to college for a year in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing was always to see the world. I wanted to see the world. I knew my world was, as Entezaki says, was more than the 40 blocks of where I live.
Exactly. Yes,
and so
exactly.
I went to Puerto Rico, and that was an experience. And then when I went to Sweden, I said, okay, so what are you going to do? So I did office temp. And office temp gave me an assignment at Channel 13. So I walk in there as a receptionist with a micro mini skirt, because that's what they were wearing in Stockholm. And my father was having a nervous breakdown because he kept telling my mother, he didn't tell me, he said, why are her skirts that short? Why is she walking around like this? And my mother said, I don't know, Victor, but I'll get a chair and sit outside the house and I'll look at her for you. Would that please you? Now, nobody ever said anything to me, but she told me, she said, oh no, he was crazy. He couldn't believe it. Then I got bursitis, and he was saying because the skirts were so short. I said, but the bursitis is in my shoulder. But anyway, so I got the job. I got the office temp job at Channel 13, and Ellis Hazlip said, would you like a job? Would you like to be the permanent receptionist? I said, I can't. I have to be a professional actress, so I really can't take any jobs right now. I said, but I'll do you a favor and I'll stay for like 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, fine. And so I ended up staying 13 years, but I got my first theater job from being at Channel 13. Okay, when I got back, because I had done Shakespeare in the Park before.
Yes.
And then the woman who was in the office, who I was sharing the office with, she said, Anne, I'm going to do a show, A Salute to Black Women. Would you like to be in it? Because you said you're an actress. I said, I would love to. And this was the height of the Black Power thing.
Mm-hmm.
I
mm-hmm.
decided not to do any dashikis. I went to Bloomingdale's and got a dress that was cut down to my navel. And I was on the Black Power show. And that's when I did a recitation of High on the Hog. She gave me this poem to read. And that's when I saw the power of TV. I said, oh, shucks. People start recognizing me. They said, you did High on the Hog. I said, yes. But my mother said, my father was sitting there looking, and she kept saying, Anna, don't breathe. Don't breathe. Because the one thing I was very confident about was my bust. Mm-hmm. And I, at 19 years old, wanted to show the world how beautiful I thought my bust was.
Mm-hmm.
Black power or no black power.
Okay.
And
all
in
right.
fact, they just re-aired that show on Amazon Prime.
Did they really?
Yes. They have a series of, I think, 15 of the soul shows.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right.
That they just aired. You have to look that up. Really.
It was really. I want to read just a little bit of the mission of Soul, because I don't think the people realize the impact that Soul had. It was Soul's mission was not merely to entertain black viewers, but to challenge them to ponder the possible meanings of black culture and black community at the time when blacks were driving America's social transformation.
Well, let me just say this. Black people couldn't be on TV then.
No.
The Soul Show came out of the riots. When they had the riots in 1964, black people, the only thing that entertainers could be on, if you were fortunate enough, and I think they had one or two black people from Motown, was the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yes.
So
we did
not have a venue.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman, Kit Lucas, had a friend called Ellis Hayslip who was on tour with the Amen Corner in Europe, and he called him and he said, I wrote a proposal and PBS wants to fund it. We want to put together a show that exhibits black culture and talent. And that's how Soul came about. So we were the only trip in town that displayed it. So we had everybody from Muhammad Ali. The only people we couldn't get were the Motown acts, because they did not necessarily want to be associated with a black show. He said his talent was worldwide, and that's what he did, which was fine.
Yes.
But
yeah,
when you think about it, in my lifetime, when you couldn't see black people on TV, we had poets, we had jazz, we had rap, we had the last poets with Felipe, and we had so many, many people on, you know. It was just incredible. I mean, just incredible. And the deal is, it was educating us because there was no national show.
Exactly.
So you saw these people if they came to town. And the idea of working in a place with somebody you knew, like I remember Lil Jimmy Scott, I told Ellis, I said, oh, there's this singer that a gentleman introduced me to, Lil Jimmy Scott. I said, can we get him? He said, yeah, call. And that talk about power, and I said, oh, my God.
Yes. Yes.
And to give that audience, so when Soul went off is when you realize the impact. I mean, we would walk down the street, and people would stop Ellis and say, man, brother, you don't know what you did. Because we're all starving to understand who we are and what history we come from. We all are starving. And the prisoners, we got letters from prisoners. When we were supposed to do a letter campaign, we got thousands of letters to say you can't shut it off. It was like a lifeline to who we were. And we got the notice from PBS that there was no more racism in America, so there was no need for Soul to be on.
So there was, the funding was cut for it. Well, now I have to stop because I only have 20 more minutes left, and I'm never going to get to I'm going to have to skip a whole lot. Or I'm going to have to continue.
I'll talk faster. And let me just say, we had Arsenio Hall on when he was 12, I think.
Yeah, that's
he
what
was
I
a
wanted
magician.
To ask. Yes, you did. You I want to say you discovered Arsenio when he was 12.
Well,
and
I didn't discover. I called his mother and said, we want him on this show. Verda Mae Grosma had seen him. And she said yes. And I saw her like 25 years after. I said, did you come in? She said, no, I said my girlfriend, because I didn't know what you were talking about. But they said...
And then you, and reciprocal, you appeared on the Arsenio Hall show.
Yes, and reminded
yes.
him.
Yes.
And reminded
yes.
him.
Reminded him
that
of
was
it.
His
mm-hmm.
first TV show.
Yes, yes.
And so life comes in full circles.
Of course.
Full,
it now,
full circles.
Did you not do Colored Girls? Didn't you do Colored Girls in New York?
I did Colored Girls. That was long time after. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Long,
but I mean, I don't think that people understand that you had a theatrical career as well, and then the bell for Los Angeles rang, and you went out to Los Angeles. But you were what did you used to have that on your car? Harlem Cutie. You
yes.
were
yes.
the Harlem. You were the Harlem.
Well,
Cutie.
I learned years earlier that what we do is we represent. We
mm-hmm.
unfortunately have to represent the whole race, because I might be the only one you meet that
yes.
looks like me. I did a movie in Yugoslavia, and when I went out of the hotel, the whole block would stop and turn around.
Mm-hmm.
And it did make me uncomfortable, because I was used to that in Sweden, you know,
mm-hmm.
years before.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
the cast, this was an NBC show, they said, Anna, did you notice that everybody stopped walking? And I said, they've never seen anything like me. It's okay. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the bottom line is you're representing everything you come from, not the entire race, but I'm representing all the little girls who grew up in Harlem, who had Sunday schools, who had Easter shoes, who
mm-hmm.
wore those hats. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All
we
of
had
those
the shoes
we
and the
had
lace.
The right,
yeah,
the
yeah.
etiquette all lessons.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
You have to
now,
teach little children how to use a knife and fork, how to say their grace. I mean,
yes.
all of those things. That's when you decide what parts you can take and what parts you can't.
What parts you can't. It is a personal decision, and I realize that. Now, I'm going to stop you now, because I have to go. I do have something that I want to ask you about. Recently, you portrayed Mother on
Pose or The Bold and Beautiful?
No, neither one of those. What's this? Oh,
okay.
OG.
Oh, The Last OG.
The Last OG. All right.
Yes.
And you spoke about when you were receiving an award, or you had received an award already, but you spoke about the impact that your character had on the star there, the relationship he had with his mother. Can you... It's life imitating, you know, art, and art imitating life. And this is recent now. Now I've jumped, you know, several years.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
You know,
let me tell you something. This is, we say, you know, you go in, you think you have something, and then you realize every part you get teaches you something.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
when I did the mother for Carla Mobley on The Bold and Beautiful,
mm-hmm.
I learned so many life lessons. This was about
a transgender
woman.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
the husband and I, my husband was totally against it. And I had to make a decision, because I was married to this man for 30 years, and he thought this was a big freak, and he didn't want anything to do with it, and the so-and-so, and we came out to L.A., and we saw her. And something happened when you're rehearsing the lines, and you see the people, and so-and-so. Something happened to me in that rehearsal part, which I brought to the screen. I said, the easiest way to be a hero is to be a good parent.
Mm-hmm.
Your child doesn't make a promise when it's first born, I promise I will never do this, I will not do that, I will not become a junkie, I will not become, my sexuality won't be in question, so you don't know what the child has, but you sign a paper.
Exactly.
Or in your heart to say, I'm going to love you. And I remember during one of the scenes where this girl gets married and the father goes off, and he says, "You're a freak. I don't understand what this is. I know I gave birth. Your mother gave birth to a boy. Now you're a girl." And duh. And he says, "Come on." And I said, "No, this is my child.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who I love 100% mm-hmm. and who loves me even more." And at the wedding, I apologized to the daughter. I said, "I wasn't a good mother. I knew I couldn't throw you away." And it doesn't have to be trans, but that did something to me because I said, the easiest way to become a hero, because your children can forgive you,
yeah,
you know? And I
yeah.
had a scene in Pose the same thing. I said, "Did you come with Billy Porter to cuss me out?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "No." He just wanted his mother to say she loved him.
Yes.
And that was so interesting and so powerful. And I say powerful not from an ego thing, but from people who write you or tell you what it did to them. Because a lot of people don't have a chance to ask their mother for forgiveness.
Exactly.
And a lot of us are held hostage by our religion, our religious beliefs.
Well, I do want to go right back to Tracy Morgan and what he said to you about your portrayal of his mother on the show and what it said to him about his own mother. Do you remember?
No, you tell me and I will.
Okay, because you were disappointed. Your character became disappointed with Tiffany Haddish. You were not, her character was not one that you really were in favor of. And he talked about the disappointment that he experienced from his own mother, understanding that, and how you brought that, to made him understand it in real life, because you brought that to the character. And it, again, is one of those things. Remembering.
Well, no, you know what? We've had so many talks because I have become... So, and I mean, I don't know how much I'm saying, and which is private and not private with him, because he has no filter. He tells whatever he's feeling.
Okay.
And he reminds me very much of Sherman. They don't know what they should say publicly or not publicly.
But Sherman was
remember,
Sherman was so quiet around me. He was very,
very,
very
quiet. But again, he was raised in a Pentecostal upbringing.
Yes.
The grandmother was a Pentecostal minister,
mm-hmm.
the mother. Years ago, a good child was defined as a child who didn't speak.
Speak, exactly. Yes.
Because I asked my mother, how come you didn't send us to the West Indies to spend a year or two? She said, no, I didn't like the way their children, she said, good children down there are quiet children. I always
mm-hmm.
wanted you all to have a voice. And
the
I
freedom
said, whoa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that was interesting. Because, you know, again, we don't know what our parents talk about. We don't know what they think about. We know what they say to us.
Yes.
They want basically they want us to keep us alive until we're 18. But you really don't know if they had a philosophy or what they thought. I asked my mother, why were you so free? I mean, my mother believed in sending us away to camp and to this experience and that experience. She said, because I was so old when I had you, I thought that I might not live to see you grown. So I wanted to make you all as independent as possible just in case your father married a stupid woman.
Oh, my.
And I said, oh.
Oh, okay.
Oh. So, I mean, she had a clear plan for her life out of the idea that she had children late, and she said, I didn't know. So I asked her one day, do you consider yourself successful? She said, yeah, for me to live long enough to have grandchildren, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And I said, okay. But again, we don't ask. I asked my father what his definition of success is. And one day it dawned on me, everybody has a different definition of success.
Well, but don't you think they should?
You don't know that you have to. I think we get distracted by looking at other people. When people say, oh, did you get this award? I never put awards on my bucket list.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm
yeah.
saying? For me I not to have an Oscar or for me not to have an Emmy, it doesn't distract from my success. Well, now I can say not just, and I didn't realize how long I've been in the business, but at one point I said, every other black person knows me. Okay.
Yeah.
I cannot look at that and think that's not successful.
Exactly.
Now it's every other person, not just black people. The Spanish woman at the El Pollo Loco said, that's you. I opened my window to give this homeless guy some money the other day, and I said, here. And he said, is that you? I said, yeah. Is that you? He said,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I said, take
mm-hmm.
the money.
Take the money.
And it brought such a smile to his face, whatever he thought I was, which is the weigh-ins or Miss Jones from Friday or whatever. He
mm-hmm.
was so happy that I recognized him. I have to say that success, if I can bring a smile to people who are not smiling in the morning and they see me and the first thing you do is smile, I got to take that as my definition of success.
You see, people, what I say to you when I say inspirational speaker. Here you go. Because I knew when I said that, you probably went, what is she talking about? But that's a conversation more than anything else. But it's very, very true. But success, I believe, is relative, but you've got to be strong enough to define your own success.
Yes,
and not
but no, give yourself
people.
Permission.
Exactly.
To define just because somebody else says that's it. Buying a Birkin bag. I said the Birkin bag might not be my definition of what I would do with my money.
Exactly.
I might do something else with my money.
With
I might
money.
Send 10 people to summer camp. And not trying to be any good Samaritan, but I think those stories did have an impact from Sunday school.
Well,
you know?
I think so. I think, but I also think that when you're strong enough to have a definition about your own self, when you're not, I believe that you can be within a group, but it still remain an individual and independent in your thought. So you're not led by somebody else's definition of what success should be in what your accomplishments were. I think success is when you have a to-do list in the morning and you actually get to half of it before the day is over. That's
exactly.
a great success.
Yeah.
You know?
When my mother told me what, because I taped her one day and I said, do you think you're successful? And she looked at me like, oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wait a minute, she's a housewife. The girlfriend ain't had a job since I knew her. And she said that she felt really successful. And I said, oh, well, what did you want? She said, all I wanted from the time I was a little girl to have children and give them piano lessons and dance lessons and see them grow to be good people. And I said, oh, she has a different definition than I had.
Exactly.
'Cause I thought me getting a movie.
Yes. No, no,
you know
no,
what
no.
I mean? Again, and that's when the light bulb went off and said, oh, shucks, her definition of success is not the same as mine.
Exactly. And should not be.
But I didn't know. Again, we walk around with ideas and we don't question the ideas of where did we get that belief system from. And
exactly.
not to say you're wrong. You just have to say, my parents' definition of good children were that you never have to grow up and go to jail, that you didn't hurt anybody,
mm-hmm.
that you became good people. It wasn't
mm-hmm.
about go to Hollywood. It was, no, is Anna a good person?
Exactly. You see, I think that as we've gotten now into the philosophy of life and especially in our business, and so many people recently, someone had asked me, they wanted to talk about a book that they thought they had written a book that would show people how to be successful in something. And I thought guidance is something else, but there's no formula to in a particular business of success. It all, you can do the same exact things as somebody else and still
get a different result.
So the simple fact is that, you can say, look, here's some guidance in your way, and then you take what you can from that and do the best that you can do with that. That's, that is Ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that we are down to the last few minutes of this hour. I told you it goes quickly. And, you know, one of the things that I have to tell you that I said it at the very beginning of this, and I'm going to bookend this, is that I remember being new to Los Angeles, and you were there for a while, long enough to have become a star in your own television show. And I will forever be in your debt of how welcoming you were. And also in the debt of a writer, and I don't know if you remember, I had to go look, I saved a couple of scripts from that, because there's certain things, you know. And Artie Julian, do you remember Artie Julian?
Oh, yes.
Artie Julian wrote the episode that we first did together, which was Selma's Reunion. And in Selma's Reunion, the name of my character, you were Thelma Fry, yes, and my character was Jackie Dunn. And he came to me at the end of the appearing after a couple of times, and he said, you know, I named that character after my little girlfriend in elementary school.
Oh, Jesus.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, was that little girl black? Oh, I couldn't, you know, I mean, I just wasn't.
Yeah, right.
And I remember at his memorial service, his daughter came up to me and said, my father always was happy that he named the character Jackie Dunn.
Oh, my gosh.
Old circle kind of thing, you know.
That is amazing. I finally met her because when I read that he died, I wrote the wife a letter.
Oh, did you?
And when they were cleaning out the house, she's best friends with my best friend, who's a vocal coach, and she said, I got the nicest letter. I found this letter my mother kept from Anna Maria Horsford. And he said, that's my good friend. And she said, I would love to meet her. She said, my mother, because I told her what an interesting time I had with, I did not know that, Lenny.
That
is so sweet.
It was the sweetest. But my whole time coming there, playing that character, you know, and he would always be inspiration. He would write things that really
made
it.
Oh, my God. Ever gets lost. Nobody is ever forgotten. You might not get talked about, but you haven't been forgotten by somebody. And I always say yesterday's lesson, I said a 13-year-old boy from high school, you know, is now, you know, directing a movie and thrilled that he knew me at 13.
There you go.
I'm saying, God, dog.
When you make
an impression, make a good one.
That's all I'm
make
saying.
Make a good one. You
and
know what I mean?
That,
because you are going to run into the person again.
Now, with that, I'm going to start to end this particular program because we're going to go on video, you and I. And we're going to do a few minutes on video, and it'll be on YouTube and on the Godly Entertainment page on Facebook. And we're going to wrap this up for a little bit. But if I know us, we'll be doing another one of these. But I cannot thank you, my friend. You know, we only got 90 seconds left. The stories that I knew that you would bring up and the part that the public doesn't know that I love you so much. And thank you for being my friend. And thank you for coming on this program. Thank you for all those years of kindness, because believe me, I went on other shows and it wasn't that. And that's not for any more publication other than saying just that.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm going to say good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Anna, for coming on. And I'll see you on the radio another time. And I'll see you on video in a few minutes.
Okay, darling.
We'll take 5 minutes. All right, my darling. I'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Thank you. See you next week, Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Everybody's got the feeling.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I love you.